Everyone ready? Okay, so the next stuff we're going to look at are deadlines, fines, holds, and registered not paid, aka when we drop students. So, first of all, what are the academic deadlines that affect the student's fee account? We have the add drop deadline, which is usually around the second, third week of school. We have the withdrawal with full refund deadline, which also affects the student's account. Again, making sure everyone's on the same page, the difference between the two, add drop deadline, add or drop a course. If they drop a course, it never shows on their transcript. Withdrawal with full refund period is when they get a W on their transcript, but they still get their money back. Okay? There's a 1 week period of the year that they get that. So this year it was the 20th or the 21st of September. Any student who drops a class after the 20th of September gets a W, so it doesn't affect their GPA, but they don't get their money back. There is a sneaky workaround to that, and it's only if the faculty is on board with doing this or graduate studies office, is that a withdrawal can be backdated. What that means is that whoever's processing that withdrawal is they trick the system and they put the date of withdrawal to be before the 20th of September. They usually do it on that deadline. So that way the system thinks, oh, they withdrew on the 20th, and so I'm going to give them their money back, even though they withdrew for medical reasons halfway through November. Okay? So in that case, when you have students asking about that, it's undergrads, you need to send them to their student affairs office. Graduate students, Danielle, if you can correct me, is it grads to the GPS, not their department, right?
Yes.
Or either or?
Yeah. It's okay. The dean's office. But rather than postdoctoral studies, the people who need information about dropping off or withdrawing, they deal with the grad studies.
Okay. Which means they'll maybe be dealing with these people? Or is that staying?
With
Shelly. Okay. Fiorella. Yeah. Okay, so grad studies then, if it's leave of absence or withdrawals past a deadline but they still want their money back, it's going to be the dean's office?
No.
What are we calling it? Graduate?
Graduate and postdoctoral studies.
Graduate and postdoctoral studies, not the department. Undergrads, it's their student affairs office for their faculty. Other things that affect deadlines, the last day of classes, as we all know, is the deadline to change your fee residency. So that affects the student fee account, because if they don't change their fee residency, we're still going to bill them potentially as international or Canadian when they're not. So that's another big deadline for students. And during the summer, the deadline for them, in most cases, is the fourth day of class, is an important date for students. The way summer classes work, if it's a regular and not a condensed summer class, is students have up until the fourth day of class to drop a course and get their money back. Okay? It's not always the case, and I have like 2 pages of instructions on how to find out what that exact date is. But we're not the summer term yet, so we'll deal with that next term. Those are the big dates. Do you remember earlier when we were talking about health and dental insurance? And if a student withdraws after the withdrawal with full refund period, the health and dental insurance is not automatically taken off. Okay? In addition, if a student withdraws between the add drop deadline and the withdrawal with full refund period, which is 1 week, we also do not automatically take off the health and dental insurance. The reason for that is because during that 1 week, there's a date in there that for the next year, faculties will be backdating withdrawals to. So it may be the end of December and they're backdating a withdrawal for a student. So we don't want the health and dental insurance to automatically reverse off for 2 reasons. One, the student may have already used it and made a claim, which means they have to pay for it. Or two, they may want to keep it. Okay? In some cases, they don't have other private insurance and they want to keep it. So even if they receive a retroactive withdrawal, they're still entitled to be covered for it for the year. Okay? Okay. late payment, late registration, late course at drop charges, all sorts of fines and fees on the students' accounts. We have quite a number of them. Late payment charge, we penalize students in addition to the interest charges at the end of the second month. So it means end of October, end of February for the winter term. We charge them a late payment charge of $35, going up to $50 in the winter, if they still have more than $50 owing on their account. Okay? There are some exceptions to that, and student accounts spends many, many hours cleaning up students' accounts before we charge this fee. For example, if the only thing they owe is residence from October, they'll still get the interest charge, but we're not going to charge them the late payment charge. Okay? If a student... There's another exception, but it's something that we're talking about next week, so I'll bring it back up next week because I don't want to throw too much into the mix right now. Late registration charges, those are following those certain dates in the calendar. A returning student this fall had up until, I believe it was the 27th of July. Thank you. 27th of July to register for courses for the fall term. If they register after the 27th, by the first day of class, a regular returning student got charged $50 as a late registration charge. If they only register after the first day of charge classes, they get charged $100 late registration charge. Manual. It is manual at that point? Okay. The charges mostly get put on by a load. We actually get a list from enrollment services of all these students, and we load the charge to the student's fee account. And then students will appeal for different reasons. My registration was closed, and my advisor advised me not to register until this point. Undergraduate students need to talk to their faculty, and grad students talk to graduate and postdoctoral studies, and potentially that fee will be reversed. But in most cases, it won't. That's why it really is important. It's not that they registered by the first day of classes, it's that they registered within the regular registration period. And late course add drop, these, I believe, are put on manually when students are added or dropped from courses late because it's a manual transaction being handled by graduate and postdoctoral studies or by, for undergrads, their department. And the student count holds, which we'll talk about in just a second. Okay, so if you look at the major deadlines, it's really tiny here. It'll be better when you see it on your actual slides. These are not all the deadlines, but it's just I want you to give you an overall view of how the cycle works. So we looked earlier at August. So we're going to go back even a couple of days earlier in August. As of August 1st this year is when we assessed students for the fall term, remembering that assessed means charged. So as of August 1st, if they were registered, they could see all their tuition fee payments for the fall term on their account. Whatever their balance was at that time, on August 4th, we sent them a bill. August 28th, they had to pay us. Okay. So interest charges happen, and then on September 4th, we send out another bill. So we're starting the next month and the next monthly cycle. Within this month now, we have deadlines that are going to affect the student's account. So on the 15th, we had the add drop deadline. Remembering, they get a refund, nothing shows on their transcript. The September 20th withdrawal with full refund period. They get a W on their transcript, and they get their money back. And then on September 30th, is the due date for the September bill. And we see in here late registration charge. Okay? So because withdrawal full refund period is that ending period when students should technically be adding any courses after that point in time, but before this period here, we add those charges to the account. Okay? So again, it's student accounts working in conjunction with enrollment services to make sure those charges get onto the account in time. Okay? Student accounts doesn't typically passively just wait for stuff to come to us. We have a schedule like 1,500 lines long of all the stuff that happens every year. And we get loads from all different places, and we really try to adhere to that and work with all our different partner units to make sure the charges get in on time and correctly for the students. September deadline, October bill gets sent. October bill was due on October 30th, and it keeps going on. Okay? We hit December 1st. as of December 1st is when the winter term tuition and fees will be charged to the student's account. Yeah, so if they're registered at that time, they will see the charges and payments on their account. On December 4th, we send them a bill, and then it's due on January 6th. Again, remembering because we're closed over the holidays, we can't reasonably expect for them to pay, well, especially banks are closed and everything else. So as a heads up, January is going to be fun, because you have all returning students wanting to pay at the same time. And even though, say, about 85% of our population pays through online banking, it's still quite a number of students who like to come into the office and pay in person. January 6th is due. Again, we charge interest in between. We send another e-bill. It's due at January. Monthly cycle repeats itself. In the winter term, for space reasons, we didn't show, but the same thing happens, is you have drop deadlines, you have withdrawal with full refund deadlines that affect the student the same way. Okay? And then April 1st is when this fee assessment comes on for the summer term. Okay? So we kind of see everything, fall and winter are very, very similar. Obviously, dates are a little bit different, but you have the same add drop, withdrawal with full refund that happens. Do you have questions about the general cycle, how it all works? Good? Okay. Okay. So we have the different deadlines. When people don't meet the different deadlines, and for other reasons, we charge them fines. Okay. This is a small list. Just as a note, our website, everything I talk about is on our website. On our website, you'll see something called the fee information booklet. It's a PDF document that we used to print and mail, and now we just print a PDF for our website, and next year potentially won't even be doing that. Because it's a PDF document, it doesn't change. So any numbers that are reflected in it are not necessarily the right numbers. Anything on our website is the most current information. Okay? So we talked about the different registration fines, the deadlines for $50 or $100 for late registration. When a student withdraws from the university, if they are a new admit, they lose their deposit. And if they are a returning student or they were a new admit with no deposit, we charge them $100. It's an administrative fee for they were registered, the work that has to go into withdrawing them from the university. We have other things like return payment fines. If we get a check that bounces, we charge them for it. Their bank charges them for it. They should pay through online banking instead. Students have reread supplemental exams, items like that, the late payment fine, interest, $20 when they need a new ID card, items like that. A couple of other ones that to point out that we're going to be talking about next week, charges when they want a refund. If they want a refund back by check, we charge them because it costs us money to print a check, and they're just being lazy and not putting their information in Minerva for direct deposit, as well as reinstatement penalty. Just want to make sure I'm going to the right place. Okay, I'm going to come back to the reinstatement policy in just a second. Fees go up. We try to inform students when they go up. We have disclaimers on our website saying these are not the final numbers. Fees can increase at any time. We try to inform students properly when there's last-minute changes. For example, a lot of these penalties have gone up this year and are going up again in the winter. For example, the late payment fine was $25 last year. It's $35 this fall, and it's going up to $50 in the winter. Okay? We want them to pay on time. Whenever we do have new charges, again, they're advertised on our website. And same thing, when there's big changes to administrative fees or large changes to international tuition and stuff, we do try and contact the students, keeping in mind, try not to spam them. It's a delicate balance. Okay. Have you guys talked? Yes. Thank you, Ritu. It's when you register for your first class. So a student can be registered for one class as of the 26th of July and then not register for their other four classes until the first week of September. They won't get charged. It's only if their first class that they register for is after either this year with the deadline of the 27th of July for the first day of classes.
And the labor should get charged on a specific day, overnight type of thing?
You mean, how do we get the charge? No, we get a list from Enrollment Services, and Enrollment Services looks at, can't remember what field exactly, but they look at basically the date that the first class of that term was registered for, and then they say, does that fall in the period, like, is that first class before the 27th? If so, no charge. If it's between the 27th and the first day of classes, it's the first level of charge. And if it's from the first day of classes onwards, it's the second day of charge. And then they actually give us a file with the student's name, ID number, and the amount to charge. It's not something that student accounts calculates. Yes?
FYI, for grad students, it's not the first course, it's the term. So if they need to be confirmed registration for fall and winter, most of them.
Okay. So it's when... So it's when the registration course goes on their account.
It's a what we call
e-term.
Phony course.
Okay.
They confirm registration of the fall before choosing courses.
Okay.
But a lot of students, like in master's thesis and PhD, they don't need to take their courses because they're finished their residence requirement period, so they're working on their thesis, but they still need to be registered for
okay. Registrants. Does everyone understand that? Yeah. Okay. Have you guys talked about holds, like registrar's holds, in your previous sessions? No? Okay. A hold is something that we can put on a student's account that will stop them from doing a wide variety of aspects of different activities. Specifically for student accounts, our holds stop students from ordering transcripts, adding or dropping courses, as well as when you go into any of the student accounts forms in Banner, there's a little block that you have to override. So it's kind of a heads up of, oh, there's something on the student's account that I need to look at. Okay? Now, we have holds for a variety of reasons. The most common hold is called an AR hold. And there's a web link here that lists all, seriously, there's like 24 different holds, holds and what they're for. The most common one is called an AR hold. It's when a student has more than $100, more than 60 days overdue. Okay? So if we bill someone at the beginning of August, 60 days comes up around the beginning of October. So they would get a hold on their account if they hadn't paid it, or if they had still had more than $100 outstanding. And we do this as a prompt to please pay us. This time of year especially, that for students who still haven't paid their fall term, they're looking to start adjusting their courses for their winter term. And we won't lift their holds until they either pay or with one of the managers, they can make a payment arrangement. Okay? There's other holds, for example, if a student is no longer registered, if they have between $10 and $100, they get a particular type of hold. If a student has been sent collection letters or is with a collection agency, which I'll go into more detail in a minute, they also get a hold. There's McGill loans that get issued, and our office is responsible for collecting those loans. If they're delinquent, holds go on for all those reasons. Okay? And again, more details can be found there. And on Thursday, when we show you the forms, we'll show you what it looks like when a student has a hold. Okay, so registered, not paid. What this is that we don't want students carrying a balance from one term to the next. Okay? It gets them into too much trouble, interest is collecting, and they're not able to pay it off. So what happens is at the beginning of every term, Neela in our office, who's responsible for collections and reports, takes a look at all students registered in the fall term. So let's talk about the fall. Fall term, and still owe money from the summer, winter, whenever the last term was that they were registered. We try to contact them by email. We send them a letter, and we also try calling them to either get a payment in full of their old debt, not this term yet, or at least to have a payment arrangement made with them. If by the end of the withdrawal with full refund period, which this year was the 20th of September, if they had not paid or made an arrangement to pay, we dropped their fall registration. Okay. What happens is that we have two deadlines that the students don't know about. There is the first deadline, and then we wait a week and try contacting the faculties and international student services for international students and graduate and postdoctoral studies for grad students to try and see if they have contact with the students. If they just come and talk to us, like, we have no problems with payment arrangements. We want to help them continue to study, but we have to be paid for the service that we're providing. So this year, around October 4th or 5th, we sent a list to enrollment services to drop the courses. What happens is that the courses get dropped and the charges reverse off their accounts. But it's not a permanent drop. So we give another month. So the student now is no longer enrolled in the fall term. They have been sent, we email them to inform them, we've tried contacting you, you haven't paid us, you haven't even contacted us to make a payment arrangement, we've dropped your fall term. Quite a number of them come back to us and say, oh, I'm sorry, I was busy, I didn't know, and they make a payment arrangement with us, and we can reinstate them. The way the drop works is that it, I don't understand the registration side, but apparently it's quite easy for, I think it's Fiona or Paula, who puts their course back on the record. And so then the student's back enrolled. So there was a reinstatement charge on the previous slide. If we have dropped them and they only come to us after that point, we charge them $150. It is unbelievable how much time and energy goes into trying to track these students down, and had they just responded to our first email, they wouldn't have been dropped, they wouldn't have been panicked about the money, we wouldn't have been spending the man hours to try and contact them. So we do penalize them for that. If there are students who still don't contact us, it's usually a month later, so it was actually earlier this week, we drop deleted these courses, which means they are completely removed from the student's record. So there's no way to reinstate them. They actually have to apply for readmission to the university. Okay? Yes?
When you're dropping their courses, yep, for them, does that mean if they're in a limited enrollment class, someone else can go in and take that? Oh, no, it's after drop back, right? So they,
yes,
can, someone else can get,
yeah,
into that course to take their space.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. No, but it's a very valid point, which is also one of the reasons why we only do it after. So in terms of numbers, the fall term's usually not too bad. I think we only did the initial drop of about, it was only about 20 students or so, and then earlier this week, we only dropped, deleted 3 students. Okay, so it's not a large number of students. As I say, the fall's usually not too bad because we have so much time, they pay over the summer. They have lots of time. It's much worse in the winter term because they're going right from a fall term that they couldn't pay to being charged for a winter term that they can't pay for either. There's usually a higher number of students that we do drop. We don't like to do it, which is why we say if you would just call us and talk to us, we can make payment arrangements, we can speak with International Student Services, and we can direct you to the right resources to help pay your account. We don't want to do this, but we can't just keep letting them incurring more debt. Any questions about registered not paid? Okay, this is something that may be a little bit more familiar to you guys. We're looking at application fees. Okay, so application fees first. We all know that students have to pay to make an application to come to the university. It's done typically through Minerva. This year, I believe it was $85 to apply to an undergraduate program. And so they pay with a credit card through Minerva. For all registered students, this charge and payment, so charge and payment for the same amount, so they net to zero, will appear on the student's account in November. Okay? The reason why we add it to the student's account is because it is tax receivable, which means we're going to include it on their tax receipts as part of their education amount. We do not add it to the accounts of non-registered students, because there is a dollar limit on what a student can claim, and this amount is below that dollar limit. Okay? So it's just for registered students. And to make stuff even more fun, remember when we were talking earlier about how Mel's said we couldn't raise administrative fees by more than a certain amount every year? Okay? The application fee is an administrative fee. And so the university decided that this was one of the ways it was going to increase its revenue, so it increased the administrative fee. But for applicants who become students, that brings them above that cap of what we could increase. So we actually have to rebate them part of their application fee. It's the first time this is ever happening. I hope it goes well. So for a SAGEP student, they will be getting, or a SAGEP applicant, they will be getting an $85 charge, their $85 payment, and a $20 rebate. For a non-SAGEP applicant who is now a student, they get the $85 charge, $85 payment, and a $5 rebate. The reason why there's a difference is because the application fee went up from $65 to $85 for SAGEP applicants and only from $80 to $85 for non-SAGEP applicants. So it's going to be a little weird. I hope it goes well. I'll report back in a couple of weeks. Did you have questions about the application fee? No. Other note about application fees, there's a very small subset of students who cannot pay by credit card on Minerva. I'm sure for those of you in enrollment services, you've sent them up to student accounts before. They can pay by certified check or debit in our office, and we just move the money to the specific VOPL that pays for application fees. Okay. Admissions, deposits, and forfeitures. So a student has applied, gets accepted, they have to pay money to confirm that they're coming to McGill. The most typical one is the $200 for undergraduate students. Again, this is something that is paid for through Minerva using a credit card, and it shows up right away as a deposit on their account, and it will be used as a payment towards their first term tuition and fees. If they make the deposit and they decide they're not coming to McGill, they lose the deposit. Okay? It's called a forfeiture. Those are charges that student accounts puts on the account to net it out to zero. Also, in certain cases, there's a small subgroup of students, something to do with medical program, who also can't pay using a credit card to accept their admission to McGill. They also come to see us. We take the payment and put it onto their student account. Yeah? Questions about admissions deposits? Okay. Other type of deposits are housing deposits. A student on the downtown campus has to make a deposit of $1,500 in order to reserve their room and residence. At the MAC campus, I believe it is $500. Okay? That rate can sometimes change from year to year, but it's been consistent for a couple of years now. Same thing, that deposit gets used to pay for their residence, usually their first month of residence. If they decide not to come into residence, depending on the date that they tell residents they're no longer going to be there, they may lose all of their deposit, none of their deposit, or a percentage of their deposit. Okay, that is all handled by the student housing office. Other types of deposits can be SIE, SIF, Special Intensive English, Special Intensive French. These are intensive language programs that are offered by continuing education. I don't know how much experience you guys have with continuing education. Technically, students are charged and can pay at continuing education, but because student accounts is the one who's actually sending them the bill, we do get a lot of questions about content and what they're being charged for and things like that, so you probably will be learning a little bit more about the content world. So the SIE, SIF deposits are deposits for special intensive language programs that need to be paid in advance of their course, and it's a little bit less than $2,000 right now. Again, paid through Minerva, usually by credit card, or their wire transfers or checks, but most of them are by credit card. And ConEd takes care of canceling or deferring it. So if a student applies to these language programs and decides not to come, they're charged $200 cancellation fee. If they decide not to come one term, but they're going to be coming a following term, they get charged $200 deferral fee. Okay? They're not very big classes, and apparently they're very competitive to get into. Okay, the different methods of payment. Online and telephone banking is the way to go. Has anyone here not done online banking before? You? Okay. It's fairly simple. You log into your bank's website. So I'm with RBC. I would log on to my RBC bank site. I would set McGill up as a bill to pay. When it asks for an account number, it's my student ID number. I pay. 2 to 3 days later, McGill gets the money. Easy for the student. They don't need to go anywhere, or their parent. Easy for us, because we get an electronic file from the bank, so we don't need to manually enter all those transactions. Very few errors. Most common error is they've entered their student ID incorrectly, and they're paying someone else's account, which we find and move. It's astounding that, like, you're paying, like, $2,000 to go to school, and you don't double-check that you've entered in the right account number. I love the students. I really do. So online banking is really the way that we push. Only works with Canadian bank accounts. And with most banks, there are a couple of small, like, out west, there's a lot of small, like, trust companies. They don't do online banking, so they don't work, but we have other ways for them. They can pay by check. Yes?
Just to go back, I don't know if you mentioned the percentage
of students. Yeah, it's about 80% who use online banking. We really encourage it. It really is quite easy. The holdouts are really people who their parents don't feel comfortable with online banking. And as I say, we can't force it. I understand people's, like, concerns about security and stuff like that. It is very personal information, so we can't push it. We just encourage it because it is the easiest way to pay. Checks. We do accept personal checks. They don't need to be certified. In U.S. or Canadian dollars. In some cases, we do get checks that are in U.S. or Canadian dollars that are drawn on a foreign bank. We get a lot from Pakistan and India. They don't have, like, no little black numbers across the bottom of a check. They don't have those numbers, and so we have to do extra work with that check in order to get the money. So we don't love those, but we'll still accept them. Checks, students can come in person, or they can send them in the mail. We try to dissuade people from sending us stuff in the mail, because if we get it late and interest is charged, we will not reverse interest. Okay? Which is why sometimes we get people who were FedEx and couriering us their checks, because they want to make sure they don't get charged the interest.
Or simply they sent it out in the mail a week ago, it's
arrived. Yes. Well, I love the McGill mail room, but everything's sorted by hand. And, for example, you have the October 28th deadline for all returning students to pay their their fall tuition and fees. That's a lot of students. That's a lot of checks for the students who decide that they're still going to pay that way. And they don't necessarily make it through the McGill mail room in time. And it's only once we have them in our hand that they get entered. And so if we receive them late, if Canada Post or U.S. Post or whatever else is slow, it's their tough luck. Which is why we try not to encourage people to send checks, as well as there's so many ways to go wrong with filling out a check. Like, the people who the number and the written out number don't match. They forget to sign it. The date's wrong. So there are errors, again, which is why we don't encourage it, but we accept it. We also do accept post-dated checks. And we have a way of recording them in our system. The only drawback of a post-dated check is it does not prevent interest from being applied to an account because it's not real money for us yet. So if the due date was October 28th and I have a post-dated check for the 15th of September, that's not money I can get until the 15th of September, so the interest is going to stand on that account. Post-dated checks are often used in collection cases or payment plans with students who are having trouble paying off their balances. We do accept debit cards in our office, only Canadian debit cards, and not the combo check debit cards, credit debit cards. Our machine is not set up to take that. Debit cards, the most common problem we have is that students want to pay $2,000 and they have a daily limit of $500 or $1,000, which is why we say that they can call their bank and get their daily limit extended for the day or pay through online banking. sorry, always the fallback. Pre-authorized debit. What this is it's a way for students or their parents to give us their banking information. We set it up in our system. They log into Minerva to initiate a payment, and then we go and electronically take the money from their bank account. This works for Canadian accounts and U.S. accounts. So it's very, very popular with our U.S. students and parents. This also works when I was talking about those little trust companies that don't do online banking. This is a way a lot of those students set up to pay McGill. because they, the money appears in their student account overnight, and it takes usually about 2 business days before their money is withdrawn from their bank account. The problems that come up with it are it's a bounced item because they've accidentally entered that they want to pay $10,000 when they only meant to pay $1,000, and they don't have that in their account, even though we asked them to confirm it twice. Another thing is that for U.S. accounts, we have to take exchange rate into account. Actually, just maybe to step back for a second, for checks, we apply an exchange to it on the day we receive the check. Okay, and it gets entered in the account, and McGill changes its exchange rate daily. So for pre-authorized debits, because we're pulling from a U.S. account, but they're trying to pay in Canadian dollars, is the money needs to be converted. And it is RBC who does the conversion, not McGill. So sometimes what happens is that a parent has underestimated what the exchange rate is going to be, because there might be a day or two delay between when they initiate the payment and when RBC does the transfer, or does the conversion, sorry. And so they may not have enough money in their U.S. bank account. For returned items that are Canadian, it's the same charge as a return check, $35. For returned items from U.S. accounts, we do not charge a return fee, because 100% of the time they will lose out on the exchange rate. Because there's different exchange rates whether you're buying or selling Canadian dollars, and it works out disadvantageously, and it's usually by a couple $100. So that's why we tell people, make sure you have enough money in your account. We do accept wire transfers. They're a pain in the butt because wire transfers go through something called the SWIFT network, which means they hit like multiple different banks between India and our bank, and often information gets lost along the way, like which student it's for. So we'll have like $3,000 sitting in our account, and we don't know which student to pay. And it also takes longer than the 2 to 3 business days their bank will tell them it's going to take, just by the time it gets routed to us. So it's a slow method of payment, but it is a way. Another option is Travelex, which is a company we've partnered with since June. We've had almost $1 million of payments come through Travelex since June. It's an alternative to wire transfers or pre-authorized debit for U.S. accounts. What happens is that through our system, through Travelex's system, they get a quote for an exchange rate that is fixed for 72 hours. They take that information to their bank, and they are paying a domestic account at their bank. So they're not wiring money from, even let's use the States, they're not wiring money from the U.S. to Canada. They're going to wire money from their U.S. account to Travelex's U.S. account. And then Travelex in Canada pays us in Canadian dollars. The advantage of this system is, A, we get the money quicker because it's a domestic transfer on the student side, and we get an electronic file from Travelex instead of us having to deal with our bank to figure out who the wire belongs to. There's a lot more. Travelex, I find, is better explained by pictures. If you want to take a look at our website, there's actually a brochure that has a good visual image of how it works on the back. Questions? Okay, we do not accept cash. If they have to pay $2, we have a small petty cash or float. We'll accept it. If they're an exchange student leaving the country, we'll never see them again. We'll accept the $2. It's usually a man. Yes. Oh, thank you. Yes. Interest is only charged on balances of $10 or more. So what we tell students is that they pay all their tuition and fees up front, and in September they get a 50 cent printing charge, in October they get a $1.50 printing charge. We tell them, don't pay it until it's more than $10 or you're leaving the university. Because they're not being charged interest on it, and depending on the methods of payment, like to give us a check for 50 cents, which we have received before, is sometimes a little bit silly. So generally no cash, generally no credit cards as well. The reason for that is that for credit cards, we get charged not only per transaction, but a percentage of each transaction. Okay? It's too expensive for us to do. Within the past year, Dal and Concordia have both decided to no longer accept credit cards because it costs too much money. Okay? The exceptions. We talked about application fees, admissions deposits, housing deposits, special intensive English, special intensive French, some conservatory courses, any courses that we consider self-funded, meaning that what they charge covers the entire cost of the course and it's not a credit course, those programs will accept credit cards. Non-student AR means not student accounts, but the rest of the university AR will sometimes accept credit cards. AR, accounts receivable. In some cases with collection students, they've been gone for 5 years, they owe us money, it's the only way they're going to pay, we'll accept the credit card and eat the charge because it works out better for us in the end. And same things, exchange students who are leaving or have left the country. If that's the only way we're going to get the money from them, we might accept that. And again, it's a decision call by a manager in the student accounts office. Just a quick note, and this is, you're going to see this when we start looking at terms, you probably already know, terms 2009-09, the stuff everyone's familiar with. Anyone not familiar with the term, how terms are set up? Okay. Other terms that you're going to see, because you won't be dealing just with the regular day students, are 8-0 terms, which is non-transcript continuing education courses, so self-funded continuing education courses, as well as 8-2 terms for the Conservatory of Music, who give courses to like 6-year-olds and 12-year-olds. So they're not your regular students. And it's just a way for us to differentiate between their programs and ours. Okay. Students who are no longer registered with us and still owe us money. We make every effort to collect internally. We actually have a couple of lovely ladies in our office who that is their job, is to contact students who don't want to pay us and try and get them to pay us. It's not a thankful job. we try and be nice and friendly with them. If they won't play ball or we don't have contact information for them anymore, we do send them to an external collection agency. And they will try and collect. And then what happens is that, say the collection agency collects $100, we pay the collection agency X percentage of that $100. Okay? It's usually... It works, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. The advantage of a collection agency is they have better resources to track down a student than we do. In some cases, when the university or the collection agency cannot collect, and we evaluate this, sometimes the amount is just written off and their account is flagged. So if they ever want to come back and request a transcript, which happens, they have to pay us first. Or in some very extreme cases, we will actually report them to credit bureaus, both within Canada and the States. It doesn't happen very often. I was in the position that took care of that for a year, and I never did it. I'm also a little bit more of a softie than Neela is. But it does happen, and it's a disclaimer on our website that if you don't pay, we do reserve the right to report you to a credit bureau. Students who have claimed bankruptcy. Technically, they don't have to pay us because they've claimed bankruptcy. We no longer have to provide them a service, which means if they claim bankruptcy, we still won't give them a transcript. Yeah. We'll make payment arrangements and stuff like that, but we try and not give away stuff if we can. Last point, 5 more minutes. Confidentiality. I'm sure you're all very, very aware the student is our client. We cannot release information about the student to anyone. We run into a lot of problems in student accounts that parents who are paying for the student to come to McGill feel that they're entitled to know about their student fee account. And we're not even talking about what classes or their grades, just how much do I have to pay. We're not allowed to tell them. We have a couple of workarounds. The first is guest access. We've developed a functionality where a student can give privileges to somebody else. And they do that through Minerva. This somebody else, we now call a guest, actually gets their own McGill ID number. They can log into Minerva, and they see the financial side of the student at McGill. So their e-bills, their accounts, their tax receipts. They do not receive registration, transcript, or grades, or personal addresses, or anything else like that. It's just the finance. Which means that also, so they see stuff in Minerva. They receive notifications when the e-bills are ready. As well as when they call us or come by our office or email us with questions, we are allowed to answer questions within that scope. So it is going to be a little bit more of a judgment call when it comes to guests contacting the new service point, because you're going to be dealing with a very wide array of information, and for a guest, you're only allowed to talk about this with them. Okay? But it's really important that we only talk about this with them, because that's a promise we've made to the student, that I'm not going to tell your mom what classes you're registered for. I can tell her how many courses you're registered for, because if she goes to our website, she can work out the math based on how much tuition you're charged, how many credits you're registered for, but I'm not going to tell her your what, and I'm not going to tell her what grades you're getting or anything else like that, or why you dropped a course. Okay? It's very easy to give them access, very easy to set them up. A student can revoke access at any point in time, also through Minerva, so it has a lot of flexibility. So we do initially, we really try to push this at places like the parents' tent and at the ID center in the fall, and about our facts about fee sessions. We really try and push guest access, so that way when that first e-bill comes out, they're already set up as a guest, and then we don't get the angry parent on the phone or the frustrated parent because they just want to pay, and I really want them to pay. So it's really a matter of, like, I've had times where, like, I've put the parent on hold and called the student and said, please set your parent up as a guest so that we can get this figured out right away. Because otherwise they have fines that are going to go on their account and interest and holds. And so sometimes you do have to play a little bit of an advocate to help them, because students go away and they're away from home and they don't want to call mom and dad to tell them how much to pay for their tuition until there's a problem. We want to catch it before it's a problem. So guest access, as I said, very easy to set up. Not all parents are computer savvy, or sometimes you have grandparents who are paying who are not computer savvy, or the student doesn't want the parent to be able to log in and see their bills, but they still want the parent to be able to call us and ask us questions. We have something that's called the consent to release information. Again, consent to release information only about the student fee account. The student has to sign a form and give it to us, and there's ways of checking in Banner to see if a student has given consent to someone else on their account. Questions about guest access? Questions at all for me? No? Yep.
Do we have time?
Yep, we have another couple minutes.
A little off topic, yep. But we, at the Career Home Services, yep. We also print the diplomas.
Yep.
We get a $60, we ask for $60 certified check or money order.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do the reprinting, I often have direct contact with these people.
Yep.
They often ask, can we pay the $60 by check or by debit? Like, can we just go upstairs and print? Is that ever an option?
It is. From what I've been told, the reason why we don't accept checks, only certified checks or money orders for things like reprints of diplomas or application fees, is that they're not McGill students anymore, or not McGill students yet, and so if the check bounces, it's harder to get that money. If they wanted to come pay by debit, I have no problems with that. And as well, once you guys are in the enrollment services area, or the service point area, actually, as of January, you're going to have a debit machine. And if they want to pay through online banking, like, they could potentially, and this is something that, this is a little outside of my area, so I can't tell you that it can, like, be done. I'm just saying how it could be done, is that you could say, pay through online banking, but you won't actually reprint their diploma until you see that payment come into their account. And that is another way of getting the money, because you're going to have access to all that information now instead of just half of it. You'll be the ones entering the payments. So, yeah, it is possible. Yeah.
That's a lot of math.
Yeah. Yeah. Soon. Yes.
It's quite interesting that when they're reprinting an ID card, they want to pay right away the $20.
Yep.
They could just go up and just kind of deposit $20.
Yep. So she's saying is that when students get a reprint of an ID, it's usually a delay between when they get the ID and when they get charged the $20. We have no problems with them paying ahead of time. Like, we'll usually stop them and say, you don't have any money owing right now. Are you sure you want to pay this? And as long as they say, I just got a new ID, we're like, okay, the charge isn't going to appear on their account for a little while. It's not a problem. Yeah. Next week is when we'll talk about what happens when there is a credit balance, like when there's too much money on the account and what we do with that. You could take, yeah. Yes. As opposed to waiting for a bill and everything. Get the money while you can. Yes, we do too.
Just, you know, I'm the parents, they want some information on the file, but I like
the The other great thing about guest access is that a pre-authorized debit, which remember is when a student or parent gives us their bank information to then log into Minerva to make the payment, if they're a guest, they can also do pre-authorized debit because they have access to log into Minerva and look at that accounts receivable side. So actually, to have pre-authorized debit, you have to be a guest. But that's another way for parents to pay using that guest access. It's all within the same neat little module in Banner. Anything else? No? Nope. Bilateral means they pay here, they go to school somewhere else. Yes, they're charged for everything. Health insurance, yes. If they're an international student, yeah, 15 credits per term. Yeah. Yeah, so they do get charged everything. The only fees they can opt out of are the same fees they could opt out of if they were here, which is some of those student society fees, not a large dollar value. We spin it as you pay for it here, you should have access to those same services there, and I hope that's true. But remember, if they're a Canadian student and they're opting out of their health insurance, it's like $86.40 a year, and it's supplemental to their other health insurance. So they can opt out of it in the fall term if they don't want it. And if they're an international student going to school at McGill on exchange somewhere else, remember we said international insurance can be prorated. So if they're on exchange for a term, we can take them off the insurance while they're somewhere else. On Thursday, we will be going over the different forms in Banner and Minerva and looking at some students and what it looks like, as well as we'll go through how to calculate interest and working backwards, as well as how to calculate exchange rates. Thank you. No problem.